This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Professor Brown, the floor is yours.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everybody. It's great to be back here where I come a lot. So, it's always, every time, a good experience. This is a, you know, a controversial topic. This is, so I'm actually going to read paper, which I never do that. The reason I'm doing that is because everything gets recorded in this universe, and there's one thing I'm not gonna kind of accidentally, I know what I do. I mean, I always make some hyperbolic statement that really makes sense in the context, and then it gets quoted or something like that, recorded, and then, you know, I'm gonna get accused of, you know, calling for slavery or something like that. So I wasn't gonna take that risk, especially since before you guys all got here, there's this guy who always writes attack pieces against me and against IT, and then had the gall to come to this thing. He eats so much, mashallah. He comes to our events at Georgetown. He eats like three plates of food, and then he writes article attacking us. It's incredible. I mean, at least don't eat the food, you know? Anyway, I'm just stunned. Okay.
He left.
Yeah, he left. Not here anymore. So,
there is no food yet.
Yeah, anyway, Ermin took care. Ermin was very Bosnian, sort of, with him. He departed.
You're safe with me.
Yeah, so I also have pictures. I don't know if you can see the pictures okay? All right. Oh, first I want to say this will be three papers I'm writing on this topic. This part is actually, you might be surprised, I think hopefully you'll be interested. If I have time, I'll go into other aspects of it. But first, I want to talk about just the problem of Islam. The problem of slavery overall. And I think you'll understand what I'm talking about shortly, inshallah. Okay. Is there slavery in Islam? When people first pose this question, they usually assume that it's the Islam part that needs qualification or clarification. What is the nature of slavery in Islam? Everyone already knows what slavery is. Actually, it's quite the opposite. The Islam part is relatively straightforward. The real problem is trying to pin down what we mean by slavery. The more we scratch the surface of that word and try to define its reality, the more we find that our assumptions and even our words fail us. What we think we mean by slavery means little outside our own American experience. And the moment we try and fix that, what slavery is as a human phenomenon, we find that a hall of mirrors reflecting our own assumptions back at us. We all think we know what slavery is, but would we really know slavery if we saw it? So imagine we could explore the phenomenon of slavery throughout history.
Does everybody know what this is?
TARDIS.
This is a TARDIS, okay? This allows you to travel through time and space, if you are a companion of Doctor Who. Okay, so imagine that we have a TARDIS, we're able to travel throughout time and space. We hitch a ride in the TARDIS, which allows us to travel through time and space. Our first stop is an exotic desert land where slavery is common. We visit a well-off home where we find certain people performing domestic work while an older man sits drinking tea. Everyone has the same dark skin color. Suddenly, the lounging tea drinker shouts at a young man serving him and smacks him hard with a fly swatter. We are eager to know who these people are. Fortunately, the TARDIS translates all languages directly to your brain. We ask one of the man serving the tea his name, and he says his name is Saffron, and that he is one of the, quote, delicate folk working in the household. He has worked in this house for 5 years, but he tells us that in 1 year's time, he'll have saved enough money to move on and start his own tea shop. We ask him about the young man who's getting smacked. Oh, that poor boy, he says, he'll be here till the old man dies. Back in the TARDIS, we voyage through time and space, this time to meet the powerful minister of an expansive empire. The prime minister enters the throne room surrounded by dozens of armed soldiers, and we sense the trepidation in the hushed muttering of the audience surrounding us. One voice whispers, The minister is worth 80 million ducats. He's married to the king's daughter, responds another voice. The minister and his bodyguards are all light-skinned and fair-haired. Many of those there to offer petitions and seek favor have darker olive complexion. After meeting the minister, we voyage on, now to a colder land where we meet a man working in a clock factory. He hates his life, so we agree to take him with us in the TARDIS. But the factory owner catches him leaving and the man is thrown in prison. We voyage still onward in the TARDIS to a new land where, passing down the road, we see a crew of dark-skinned youths clearing brush in the hot sun, their legs shackled and all joined by chains. A light-skinned man watches over them with a weapon in hand. Where has the TARDIS taken us in our exploration of slavery? Well, the first place we visited was the city of Mecca in the 1400s. The soft and delicate Raqiq, the soft and delicate man Zafaran, was a slave in the wealthy man's household who had an agreement with his master to buy back his freedom on installments. That's called mukataba, where a slave is buying back your freedom on installments. Raqiq was the standard term for slave, and Epicurean names like Zafaran were typical. The young man being smacked for bad service, who is tied to the household seemingly forever, was the wealthy man's own son. The second place we visited was the capital of the Ottoman Empire in 1579. The minister was Sokulu Mehmed Pasha, the grand vizier and de facto ruler of the empire during the reign of three sultans. At the time of our visit, he had already been one of the empire's richest and most powerful men for almost two decades. He was also a slave of the sultan. He was born in Bosnia, as were all his guards, who were also slaves of the sultan. The land where we met the man working in the clock factory was England in 1860. Although the worker was a free man, according to labor laws in England at the time, a worker who failed to show up for work was guilty of stealing from his employer and was tried and sentenced as a criminal. Finally, the last place we visited was a land in which slavery had long been illegal, rural Arizona in 2004, where the local sheriff, Joe Arpaio, was overseeing a juvenile chain gang. That's entirely accurate. Everything I said is entirely accurate in this section. How do we know who's a slave and who isn't on our voyage? Most Westerners would probably think that the young man being smacked and the chain laborers were slaves because we associate slavery with physical degradation, harsh labor, and violence. We would probably not assume that the soft and delicate man was a slave because he told us that he would soon be moving to another job on his own terms, while we associate slavery with a total loss of agency, presumably for life. We would certainly not presume that the minister was a slave, since he clearly wielded immense wealth and power over life and death throughout the empire. If we are searching for the phenomenon of slavery, what are we really looking for? Is it the label slave that matters? Or is it the reality of the condition behind it? The soldiers and administrators of China's Manchu dynasty, the Qing dynasty, which ruled from 1644 to 1912, they were technically slaves of the dynasty and proudly referred to themselves as such. This title, slave, was later applied to anyone of Manchu descent in Qing China. But the word had no link to the reality of any servile condition. This is the ruling class of the empire, all calls themselves slaves. It said had no link to any reality of any servile condition. Up through the 1800s, the upper administration of the Ottoman Empire was in the hands of people technically classified as kul, or privileged sultanic slaves, who had more power and esteem than their free Turkish counterparts. When we come across a word that translates into slave in English, does that word necessarily mean what we mean by slavery? Actually, I want you to think about this. How would you know, if you're trying to write a dictionary, how would you know what word to translate into slave? Is there always a direct translation of our word slave? Our word slave in English comes from the medieval Latin word for the Slavic people, sclavus, since they were the population in the Balkans from which European slave traders drew their cargo up through the 13th century. Ermin, I offer you apology on behalf of Western Europeans. Okay.
I think you owe other people more apologies.
Fine. I have a running list. I'll mark you off it. A common English dictionary definition of slave is someone, quote, someone who is legally owned by another person and who is forced to work for that person without pay. This notion of slavery as reducing human beings, oh, I forgot to go to the picture of the Shoko Mehmed Pasha and the Qing dynasty. It's the Qing emperor in the 1700s. This notion of slavery as reducing human beings to things owned by people has been a major theme in how this concept of slavery has been understood in the West. It was crucial to how abolitionists understood slavery in the 18th and 19th centuries when the movement to end slavery began. But the roots of this definition go further back to the roots of the Western heritage. They lie in Roman law, which divided people into two categories. The free, a free person who has the natural right to do as he pleases unless prevented by the force of law, that was the first group, and slaves, who exist as the property of others. But even defining slavery through concepts like ownership and exploitation leaves more questions than answers. What does ownership mean? In American law, we think of ownership as a, quote, bundle of rights, the right to use, exclude, destroy, and sell off. Sometimes an owner has all of them, sometimes with significant restrictions, and sometimes the owner has only some of them. We would probably not think of kids owning their toys, since they are clearly not in control of them, ideally. But children in America do legally own their toys. They own the toys we give them. Imagine that. You give my kid just had a birthday. You give the kid a birthday present. You've given donative intent, giving the gift, reception. That means the gift has been given. It now belongs to my kid. We would probably not think of kids owning their toys since they are clearly not in control of them. But children in America legally do own the toys we give them, but their ownership is not complete since their right to use them is ideally highly restricted by their parents. Ownership is as much about how we imagine relationships as it is about exercising real control. As the famous social historian Orlando Patterson points out, who and what we say we own is really a matter of our customs and manners. Modern Americans would gasp at the notion of owning our children. But from the Roman period through the medieval period in Europe, parents could and did sell off their children as slaves to creditors in order to pay their debts. Moreover, poor parents abandoning their children was a regular source for slave markets in Europe. Yet all these children started off as technically free, in a legal sense, not legally owned by anybody. In the US, wives and husbands have numerous claims on and powers over each other and their labor, as becomes painfully clear during divorce. But we would never speak about marriage as a relationship of ownership in the United States. Conventions in early imperial China were very different. There, husbands regularly listed their free wives as property in their will, bequeathing them to some friend. Astoundingly, between 1670 and 1880, less than a century and a half ago, there were 200 cases of Englishmen holding auctions to sell off their wives, even advertising them in the newspaper. This is actually a picture of the wife auction. Now, if you're saying, what the heck are you talking about? That's what I'm telling you. Thinking of your wife as something you can own to auction off is actually not that insane, even in the Anglo-Saxon tradition. This is 150 years ago around in England. What does it mean? What would it mean to own a person? Does it mean to have total control over them? We have full control over our young children, but unlike a chair or a pen, we cannot seriously physically harm them without legal consequences. In fact, this distinction between ownership and control is not very helpful for defining slavery. As with our children today, it was impermissible for Muslims to kill or seriously injure their slaves. and those who did faced legal consequences under the Sharia. This is actually not uncommon in lots of different legal traditions to have restrictions on the kind of physical discipline you can use on slaves. So actually, they're not that different from children. As with our children today, it was impermissible for children, for Muslims to kill or Jews to injure their slaves, those who did face legal consequences under the Sharia. In some contexts, ownership might fail completely as a concept for understanding slavery. Slavery existed in Imperial China, but it was not conceptualized through ownership. This is because slaves were not legally owned at all in China, for the very technical reason that Chinese law could not categorize people as things. You simply couldn't have a person be thing that was owned in China, but there was still slavery. If we think about slavery as exploitation, does slavery mean not compensating someone for their labor? Sokolu Mehmed Pasha was a slave who was owned by the Ottoman Sultan, but he was paid handsomely for his work as a Grand Vizier. Saffron was owned by his master, but only partially, since he had already bought back a portion of his freedom through wages he earned elsewhere in his time off. And just an interesting fact, the Mukattab slaves, like Saffron, they're actually allowed to travel, they're allowed to engage in contracts, they're allowed to have business, they're actually even allowed to own slaves in some Muslim schools of law. They can even own their own slaves. So you have a slave owning a slave, because they're actually not fully owned. They're at the sort of mid area level between free and slave. Saffron received no pay from his master, but the master paid for his food, his clothes, and his shelter. Incidentally, in this regard, the slave Saffron was no different from the master's own son. Both were the man's dependents, relying on his support for their basic needs. We usually think of slavery as something that exists in dichotomy, in a dichotomy with freedom. But what does freedom mean? As the legal scholar Von Lowe jibes, inverting Rousseau's famous line about man's natural state of freedom, quote, "Man is born in chains, but everywhere he thinks himself free." I think this is a very astute observation. Rousseau said, you know, man is born free, but everywhere he's in chains. Actually, man is born in chains, everywhere he thinks he's free. We all think we're free. Almost no human being is free of dependence on others and on society as a whole. Almost everyone is forced to work in order to earn wages to buy food. The son in the household we visited in Mecca was technically free, but he depended on his father for all his support and had to obey him or face his anger. If he fled his home to get away from his nasty father, he'd be ostracized by all those he knew and loved. The man's slave, meanwhile, had evenings off to earn his own money and would soon be free of the master. Who is really free in this situation? At a theoretical level, how do we understand freedom in the West? How we understand freedom in the West is inherited from classical Greece and Rome, where free was a legal category of citizens of a democratic republic. A free person was autonomous, at liberty to do whatever he or she wanted unless the law prohibited it. Everyone else was a slave. But even in classical times, this legal definition of freedom was no more than a, quote, rhetorical argument, to quote a great scholar of slavery. Since in reality, few people in Greece and Rome were really free by this definition. Almost everyone was constrained by powerful social, economic, and even legal bonds. Ironically, even in theory, this notion of freedom only applies to liberal democracies. In autocracies, certainly the majority of societies in human history, almost no one is free by this definition. Nor does freedom exist on a single plane. It is often relational, expanding and contracting, depending on the relationships in question. In the ancient and medieval Mediterranean world, both in Europe and Islamic civilization, a slave's intense subordination was not absolute. He or she was subordinated to his or her master, not society as a whole. So Roman and later Byzantine masters used slaves to run their shops and to be the public faces of their businesses, negotiating and arguing with countless free customers and contractors on a daily basis. The slave was not the lowest rung on the ladder in the streets of Rome or Constantinople/Istanbul. If the master was a powerful or wealthy person, the slave enjoyed the status of that connection in public life. The status of the slave depended on the status of the master. By now, you should see that any question about slavery is actually very complicated. One of the biggest challenges that historians and anthropologists interested in slavery face is deciding whether there is even some single institution of slavery that exists across time and space that they can study. It's tempting to assume that, although the details might differ, there is something called slavery out there, popping up throughout history, and that we'd know it if we saw it, like pornography. But of course, as our hypothetical trip in the TARDIS shows, what we would recognize as slavery is determined by our own cultural memory of what the English word slavery means to us. When Americans think of slavery, we think of 12 years a slave or roots. The images are seared marks in our mind. And here, I wanted to play this. Sorry, one second. Just want to see if this will work. It's a little bit of a digression, but I think it's such an interesting scene. Sorry, one second. So this is from the 1999 movie Mansfield Park, which is a Jane Austen novel. So this is where the main character, I'm not sure what her name is, I forgot, but she discovers that her father, his properties in the West Indies, he actually owned slaves. This would be in the early 1800s, right? Now, but what I think is so interesting about that scene is the way the images are constructed. So it's very, that showing now. Why that's not working. There we go. Okay. The way the image is, I mean, you said, first of all, it's highly racialized. I mean, you can see these are clearly, these aren't just Africans, these are Africans who are being depicted sort of grotesquely by Europeans. It's extremely degradational, right? These people are being, they're being treated worse than animals. They're being sexually abused. They're being bred, right? I mean, this is complete racialized humiliation, degradation. This is actually fairly rare in human history. So in human history overall, slavery is not racialized. It's economic and legal condition that anybody from any race can fall into. Second of all, there's different, obviously slavery is very diverse and all, but most of the time, you actually find pretty strong legal protections on slaves. That you can't do things like, brutalize them like this. Because remember, this is this is an investment someone has, similar to a worker. Why are you going to brutalize and incapacitate your workers? Okay. The images are seared in our mind. African men and women and children being seized by ruthless slave traders, torn from their homes and each other, packed like chattel into the holds of stifling slave ships, sold like cattle at auction to white plantation owners who worked, oppressed, and lashed them mercilessly for the rest of their lives. Slavery in our cultural memory is the original sin of America, the reduction of a person against their will to the status of property owned by another person who had absolute right over their labor and who deprived them of the natural rights to freedom and family. Yet, as we have seen, ownership, freedom, and exploitation come in shades of gray. They exist on spectrums. Historians and sociologists have attempted to delineate categories on the spectrum, in part to determine if we can really talk about slavery as something separate from other forms of forced labor or involuntary servitude. The main categories on this continuum of dependency, and I think it's a very useful term, continuum of dependency, other than slavery are one, serfdom. Serfdom is usually associated with Europe. This tradition goes back to ancient Greece. Laborers, usually peasant farmers, were free in the sense that they owned their own clothes, tools, and livestock, as well as the fruits of their labor. But they were bound to the land on which they lived or to the landlord wherever he might go. Serfdom in Europe developed as the status of free peasants and settled barbarian prisoners of war in the late Roman Empire collapsed into one single class of quasi-servitude, not too different from slavery. Serfdom disappeared in most of Western Europe in the wake of the Black Death in the 1300s, though it continued in the institution of villainage in England until around the year 1600. And it continued into the 1800s in mining areas of Scotland and in German-speaking lands. Serfdom is most associated with Russia, where it came to replace slavery in agricultural and domestic spheres in the late 1600s and 1700s. Second, master-servant relationship. When serfdom disappeared from Western Europe, it was replaced by the relationship between the laborer and the landowner slash employer. Unlike our modern notion of workers' contracts, however, failing to live up to this contract was a criminal offense. Only in the British colonies in North America did the notion of free labor eventually appear in the 1700s. Yes, we Americans innovated the idea of free labor. This did not make its way back to Britain until 1875. So until 1875 in England, the contract between the worker and the employer, if that contract was valid, it was a crime, not just a breach of contract. Americans are the one who invented the civil contract of labor. Third, debt servitude. This has been one of the most widespread forms of coerced labor. When a person is unable to repay a debt, he or she becomes the slave of the creditor. This was extremely common in Southeast Asia, where our Western model of slavery was extremely rare. Finally, bonded labor or indentured servitude. This is similar to debt servitude and has been very common in history. A person willingly enters into an agreement to exchange their labor and a loss of some freedoms for a fixed period of time in return for some service or upfront payment. This is how one of my ancestors came to this country as an indentured servant in the 1650s. This differed from debt servitude because the person willingly surrenders their labor and a degree of freedom. These categories are not fixed or hermetically sealed. They bleed into each other, making it very hard to come up with a clear line distinguishing slavery from other forms of coerced labor. Scottish mining serfs often wore collars with the name of their masters on them, for example, something we probably associate in our minds with slavery. Indentured servants from Britain, who made up two-thirds of the immigrants to British North America before 1776, they could be sold, worked to exhaustion, and beaten for misbehavior. They could not marry, and in Virginia at least, they could be mutilated if they tried to escape. In Maryland, the punishment for trying to escape was death for indentured servants. Slavery in colonial America was worse, but only in that it was permanent. On the other hand, as early as the 1400s in the Ottoman Empire, people captured in war were sometimes settled to work on lands owned by the Sultan. Although technically slaves, their condition was closer to serfdom. These slaves formed families that lasted generations and passed down the land they worked to their children. Only if a head of household died without any children would his estate revert back to the imperial treasury. Later on, as Ottoman cities industrialized, factory owners preferred using slave labor because slaves would not leave for seasonal work elsewhere. By agreeing to mukataba contracts, these slaves, remember this is where slaves earn back their freedom on installments, these factory owners were able to maximize the slaves' productivity. They were in effect more like wage laborers working for a set term in a master-servant relationship than slaves. We might think of slavery as distinguished from other types of coerced labor by the question of choice. Indentured servants could choose to enter those contracts. Slaves would never choose to become slaves, correct? But reality is actually much more complicated. Outside of slavery in America, voluntary slavery was not uncommon at all. In Ming China, many impoverished tenants sold themselves into slavery when they could no longer pay their rent. In 1724, the Russian Tsar abolished slavery and converted all of Russia's slaves into serfs because serfs were offering themselves as slaves to avoid paying taxes. Serfs paid taxes, slaves did not. It was the ultimate tax dodge. Maybe this could be an option for like Republicans or something. Not advocating slaves. See, this is what happens when I read it. Not advocating enslaving Republicans. Earlier in the 15th century Duchy of Muscovy, what scholars termed a limited service contract slavery became common. In such a contract, a person asks someone wealthy for a loan for a year, at which point the person will pay them back and will also work for them in the meantime instead of paying interest. If the borrower cannot pay back the creditor in a year, the borrower becomes their slave. Most often, they became a lifetime slave. This type of slavery replaced all other forms of slavery in Russia. And yet there was also indentured servitude alongside this at the same time, differing only from slavery in that an indentured servant could not be physically harmed by the master. Unlike bonded laborers or serfs, we might think of slaves as people with little or no right to legal protection. This has often been true. In Ming China, slaves were often referred to as, quote, not human. Not only could they not own property, marry, or have legitimate children, but killing one of them posed no legal problem. Among the Toraja people of Sulawesi, which is today in Indonesia, someone who had been convicted of a capital crime could have one of his slaves executed instead of himself. A judge in South Carolina in 1847 that declared that slaves, quote, can invoke neither Magna Carta nor common law, for the law of the slave is whatever the master said. Yet not only were legal realities often quite complicated, so were the social realities behind the law. In Roman law, slaves were conceptualized as people with no rights, since they were, in theory, prisoners of war who had been spared execution. They were legally dead anyway. During the period of the Roman Republic, the 6th to the 1st centuries BC, there was no legal restriction on the master's treatment of his slaves. But such laws are not very helpful in distinguishing free from slave, however, since Roman heads of household at the same time enjoyed the exact same theoretical power over life and death over every man, woman, and child in their family. This is called patria potestas. The Roman head of household had life or death authority over every person in their household. In theory, they could kill their daughter, their son, their wife, and there is no consequence. That's in theory. As the number of slaves in the expanding Roman Empire increased, however, laws were put into place to protect them. Under the Emperor Hadrian, who died in 138 CE, excessive punishment was forbidden, as was killing slaves without a legal ruling. The emperors Antoninus Pius, who died 161 CE, and later Constantine, he of the good hair. No, I think that's actually Justinian. What the heck was I thinking? That's not Constantine. We don't know what Constantine's hair was like. He died in 337. Made it clear that if a master killed his slave in cold blood or by excessive punishment, he was guilty of homicide. And the legal code of Emperor Justinian, that's why he died in 565, it was clear that the master's rights to do violence to his slave were limited to reasonable discipline. In early America, all 13 colonies had the law had laws regulating race and slavery, which were occasionally updated. Although 10 states in the South had slave codes making it a crime to mistreat slaves, mistreatment was understood in relationship to the severity of disobedience or infringement that the master was punishing. Amputating limbs, castration, execution were all allowed as punishments when the alleged crime was severe, and it was almost impossible for slaves to challenge any treatment in court since they could not even testify. Nonetheless, in North Carolina and Virginia, a handful of people were white slave owners were executed or imprisoned for murder or for cruelly treating their slaves. As a leading scholar of slavery, David Davis observed, quote, the more we learn about slavery, the more difficulty we have defining it. A trans-historical definition of slavery has indeed proven very hard to find. As a leading scholar of Ottoman slavery has remarked, it is difficult to treat slavery as one definable phenomenon just in the Ottoman Empire, let alone globally. Nur Sobers Khan, another scholar, has observed about slavery in Ottoman Istanbul that it was so diverse just in Istanbul that it doesn't make sense to talk about slavery as a unified phenomenon in just one city, let alone in the entire Mediterranean region. Definitions of slavery have tended to revolve around three notions: the slave as a familyless outsider, the slave as property, and the slave as object of violence. But for definitions to fit all things that people today commonly associate with slavery, that definition has to be so vague that it's almost useless. So slavery, according to one person, is the forced labor of one group by another, which is just incredibly vague. Others have suggested that slavery is an outcast. Some scholars have proposed more specific definitions. One scholar argues, the most influential definition comes from Orlando Patterson, who defines slavery as always exhibiting three features. First, slavery involves perpetual domination, ultimately enforced by violence. Second, slavery involves natal alienation, which means you're unable to pass on anything. You're cut off from your ancestors, and you're unable to pass anything on to your children. You're cut off from your family completely. And third, their slavery is defined by dishonor, a state of dishonor. But Patterson's definition fails to apply in many instances to what we would otherwise call slavery. Sometimes it was the slaves who dominated free people, as in the case of the Turkish slave soldiers of the Abbasid caliphs in the 9th and 10th centuries. For even before the Ottomans began their system of imperial slaves, Egypt and Syria were ruled by the Mamluk, literally slave dynasty, from 1260 to 1517. Although they were freed after they finished their military training, the Mamluk dynasty of Turkic or Circassian warlords reproduced itself generation after generation by importing new slave soldiers into a ruling military elite that defined itself by its military slave experience. So far from being dominated by everyone, they were their own masters, and they dominated the whole state and society. Nor have those who identify as slaves always been natally alienated. Byzantine imperial slaves could own property and bequeath it to their children. The Ottoman agricultural slaves settled in imperial lands passed their estates onto their children for generations. Unlike Roman slavery, where the status of the child's mother determined its status, the main position of the Sharia was that a slave woman who gave birth to her master's child became free when the master died, as did her child. Until then, the master could not sell her. Far from being natally alienated from her child, its status as the child of a free man ensured the mother's own freedom. Elite imperial slaves like Sokolu Mehmed Pasha were natally alienated in the sense that they could not pass on their wealth to their children, But their children retain the privilege of their father's proximity to power, as well as the status of their mother. Soglu Mehmed Pasha's wife was the daughter of the Sultan, so his sons all attained high office. Later, what is more striking is that in many cases, Ottoman imperial slaves maintain their relationship to their original families in the Christian areas of the Balkans, using their newfound power to elevate their relatives. Soglu Mehmed Pasha appointed his brother as the Orthodox patriarch in the Balkans, and his cousin later followed him to the office of Grand Vizier. Later in the 18th century, the Georgian slave elite in charge of administering the Ottoman province of Egypt maintained close relations with their families back in the Caucasus and even received visits from them. Okay, last section, don't worry. When we talk about slavery, we should note that this question is not asked in a vacuum. It hasn't been for over two centuries. In conversations and debates, the response, well, does that mean slavery would be okay, is the ultimate trump card against anyone arguing indulging different values. Slavery is the ideal example to invoke because its evil is so morally clear and so widely acknowledged. Who would defend slavery? It's the Hitler of human practices. Yet despite all its power, the word slavery is rarely defined. In that sense, it is much like the word terrorism. Its power lies in the assumption behind its meaning and in the moral condemnation it carries, but it is very poorly defined. Like the word terrorism, slavery is also deeply, deeply political. Not in the sense of politics that we see in the nightly news, but rather in the sense that it is inherently tied to questions of power. Just as the practice of slavery is an extreme exercise of power by some human beings over others, wielding the language of slavery is a claim to moral authority over others. It is no surprise that the advocates of ending brutal or unacceptable exploitative labor practices such as sweatshops, child sex trafficking, forced marriages, and organ trading today refer to such phenomena as modern-day slavery. The reason for invoking the word slavery here instead of other definitions, such as bonded labor or child labor, it's clear. Slavery provokes an emotional reaction, spurs people into action, and support for a cause. From students to rock stars, who wouldn't support ending slavery? Although such practices are indeed reprehensible, with modern-day slavery, we run across some familiar problems. If we took the definition of slavery used by activists fighting modern-day slavery, and the main definition is that slavery is anything you can't walk away from. If you can't walk away from it, you're a slave. If we took that definition and applied it just to Western history, we'd find that almost nobody was free in Western history by these standards. The wife of a British slave owner in 1800 has less rights than these modern day slaves. She had no capacity to own property on her own. She was legally indistinguishable from her husband. She had no independent legal right to contract. As some scholars have observed, the most prominent advocates for ending modern-day slavery have not applied the label to the forced labor of criminals in the American penal system. This is no doubt a very political choice, since few rock stars and students would be willing to accuse the U.S. government of engaging in modern slavery. So even when invoked for noble causes today, slavery is still a deeply political word, both in the emotional reaction it triggers and in the self-censorship that people use when they apply it. The political nature of slavery is particularly pronounced in the history of Islam in the West. During the 18th and even 19th centuries, the fear of being captured by Muslim pirates in the Atlantic and the Western Mediterranean loomed large in the Western European, especially British, imagination. And indeed, thousands of British and Americans were taken as slaves in such a way. That song, you ever hear the song Rule Britannia? You know, they always play it whenever the TV ship goes to England, they have the Rule Britannia music. That song was about not being enslaved by Ottoman slave ships. We see the cultural imprint of this fear in movies like Never Say Never Again, 1983, and where James Bond rescues Kim Basinger from a remarkably out-of-place Arab slave auction. I actually have that on my computer too, but I won't make you watch it. One second, they're escaping from the bad guys. Of course, they capture Kim Basinger because they're in the Arab world. they're going to sell her as a slave at a slave auction. So James Bond has to save her. And in the movie Taken 2008, where Liam Neeson finally rescues his daughter from first Muslim Albanian traffickers and finally from a lascivious Arab sheikh. But like the selective use of modern day slavery, this conversation is selective in its claim to Western moral authority. During the same era that Europeans and Americans were decrying capture and enslavement by Muslim pirates, the enslavement by Europeans of Muslims in the Ottoman Empire was booming. And our cultural, Western cultural memories are even more selective. Western theater goers felt no outrage in the James Bond movie The Spy Who Loved Me, died 1977, when Bond visits the harem of his Arab sheikh friend. Of course, he's in the desert. Of course, he goes to the tent with an Arab sheikh who was his friend at Cambridge. And of course, the Arab sheikh offers James Bond one of the women. When in the Orient, the sheikh said, one should delve deeply into its treasures. From the British tabloids to then private citizen Donald Trump, in 2015, many parroted the claim that Muslims in Northern England were luring young white girls in as sex slaves. Some Muslims were doing this, but few media reported that the majority of the offenders were actually white men. The word slavery has been political, even when it has been invoked for the best of causes. And the political forces that have warped, that have shaped how slavery is understood, have often hobbled the best efforts of those fighting against the extreme exploitation of fellow human beings. Abolitionists in the 19th century chose to define slavery as treating human beings as property, in part because if they define slavery as harsh deprivation or exploitation, their pro-slavery opponents would just point to the factory conditions of industrial England and America and note that these free workers were just as badly treated as slaves. Having emphasized that slavery consisted of human beings being treated as property, abolitionists were left with no objection to the continued exploitation of the very same people they had just freed once it became technically illegal to own people. British abolitionists succeeded in ending slavery in the Indian Ocean in the 1830s, but they found that the laborers were still being transported to East Africa from India in the same horrid conditions as slaves with the same high mortality rates. They were just called coolies instead of slaves. Today, decades after the legal right to own human beings was abolished globally, activists referred to as new abolitionists seeking to mobilize public concern for exploitative labor have redefined slavery as, quote, not being able to walk away. Ultimately, the word slavery can mean so many things that it's not very useful for accurate communication. It often ends up referring to things we don't mean when we think of slavery, or it fails to match things we do associate with slavery. As such, the word slavery has limited use to category or conceptual tool. It's much more useful to talk about the extreme exploitation of human beings, the extreme exploitation of their labor, and the extreme deprivation of their rights. In any society, whether it has slavery or not, quote unquote, we are likely to find such conditions. Instead of fixating on a word or an ill-defined category, it is much more useful to focus on regulating conditions and protecting people's rights in order to prevent such extreme debasement. As hopefully in my next essay I'll show, this is precisely what the Sharia aim to do. Okay, thanks. I think I went a little long, but nobody is snoring. Any questions? Okay.
Now, just a reminder that we're going to take three questions at a time. We have about 25 minutes until 8 o'clock. But make sure that, first of all, you identify yourself. Number two, to make your question a question. Questions usually start with words do, is, how, why, and why not, right? And make it short and brief and concise. If it's a comment, again, make it very short, brief, and concise. I'm using three words that mean the same thing, but I hope I've stressed it enough.
Yeah, sure.
So, there's one here, and one there, and one here. All right.
You know, I have a question. You talked something about Mamluk dynasty. Can you a little bit elaborate on that? a big name because I know they have a kind of a long history. They ruled in India, and they were slaves who were trained to be soldiers, and later on they became monarchs too. And they had Raja Sultana was the first female queen. That was her father was also from a Mughal dynasty, Shamsuddin Al-Tamash. So I would like a little bit more to what you talked about Mamluk dynasty. Can you clarify that you said it was from Egypt? Because that our history doesn't say that it was from Egypt.
Okay.
They were originally Indians.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. Second question.
Yeah. Second question. First, before I start, I understand you missed the Super Bowl. It's a lot better than Dr. Bowl, so I invite you to my Super Bowl party next year.
That's very nice of you.
Yeah, very nice. Now, on to the question. Very rhetorically gifted, very nice lecture. But basically, didn't we hear a lecture about Western slavery, about the definition of Western slavery, and the omission of the problematic natures of Arab slavery, that an Arab today in the inner city of America is a Habib. You know, this is coming from the history of slavery. That you mentioned Joe Arpaio, you mentioned the economic system in the Gulf, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The wrongs of Western slavery, which we all know, do not justify the wrongs of Arab or Turkish slaves. So isn't this kind of a circular, relativistic intellectual argument that you make?
Okay, thank you very much. And the third question over to you.
My name is Safi Bin Hamid. Thank you.
I'm listening, sorry, I'm staying in favor.
Yeah, thank you very, very interesting lecture. My question is related to the Mamluk. You said that the Mamluk became free people after finishing their military service. I heard in another book or another narration that the Mamluk of Egypt, photos by laborers and so on, were proposing some past integration for the war, and Imam Azzedine Arthur Abdus Salam said that we will not impose any more taxes unless you yourself become free and I will put you in the market, and then we will solve it. Which story is more accurate or reliable?
I think that there's some initial confusion. So when we talk about the Mamluks in Islamic history, this is referring to the dynasty that was basically from around 1250 to 1260 took over in the Ayyubid area. So the dynasty of Saladin, Salah ad-Din, the Ayyubids, they ruled Hejaz, Egypt, and Syria. But they started kind of falling apart in the 1240s and 1250s, and at a certain point, there's no one left in dynasty functioning, really. So the person who was put on the throne was a woman named Shajar al-Dur, who reigned and printed coins as Malikat al-Muslimin, queen of the Muslims. But she and her son were ousted by the person who was the first Mamluk Sultan, Zahir Baybars, who led the army against the Mamluk army against the Mongols at the Battle of Ain Jalut in 1260. And he started this, what was that called, the Kipchak. They were called the Bahri Mamluks. Their barracks were in the island in the Nile, I think on the Rhoda Island. Right? So they were Kipchak Turkic soldiers who had been bought by the Ayyubids to be basically the Ayyubid main army unit. And eventually they just mutinied and took over. And what they did is they just kept buying more Kipchak Turkic soldier youth from the steppes of Russia, brought them, taught them Islam, taught them how to ride, taught them how to shoot arrows, taught them how to fight. And then when they turned, 18 or so, and they reached majority, they would graduate. They literally had a graduation ceremony. They were given their armor, given their weapons, and they were freed. So they were technically free, but the dynasty itself reproduced itself by bringing in more slaves. And then in around 1390, that group was ousted by Circassian Mamluks, who were called the Burjis, and they ruled until 1517, when the Mamluks, when the Ottomans took over. You're talking about the Delhi Sultanate. So I think in around, I think that it is 1192 is when the Delhi Sultanate technically starts. And there's a, I think there's this Ghurid dynasty, which is like these Turkic, you know, Turkic warlord dynasties, goes down and raids Delhi. And they owned Mamluk soldiers. One of them, I think, was the Khilji family. And they rebelled against their, they overthrew their owners, and they took over. And that started, I think, either three or four sort of different dynasties, what's known as the Delhi Sultanate, which rules from around 1192 till 1380s, or when, I think it's 1380s or 90s, when Tamerlane invades and destroys Delhi. Right? The difference between them and the Mamluks in Egypt and Syria is that the Delhi Sultanate only started as Mamluks. They weren't, they didn't reproduce themselves. The dynasty didn't reproduce itself constantly by buying and importing new slave soldiers from Central Asia. So that's, I think, the difference. Other dynasties in Islam in the medieval period also had slave soldiers. It was very common. But what's different about the Mamluks in Egypt and Syria is that they, one, become the dynasty, and two, they reproduce by buying new slave soldiers instead of just becoming a dynasty that, you know, has kids who are free and stuff like that. In fact, the children of Mamluks couldn't become Mamluks. So a lot of the scholars, the great scholars of Islam in the 1300s and 1400s, are children of Mamluks, because they basically were pretty rich guys with nothing else to do but read and write, so they did a lot of good scholarship. And the second question was about slavery. The gentleman who invited me to the Super Bowl party. So the reason I purposely didn't do this is not because it's not important to talk about slavery in Islam, because I don't think you can talk about slavery in Islam until you realize that there is no such thing as slavery. As a category, as a conceptual category that exists throughout space and time, transhistorically, there's no such thing as slavery. And, you know, a lot of times when people say, was there slavery in Islam? What they're really saying is there what I think the word slavery means in Islam? And then we say, yeah, there is slavery in Islam. And then they say, oh, well, that's terrible. But actually, you know, slavery in Islam or slavery in any other place doesn't have any necessary connection to what we think of slavery, as think of slavery in American context. In fact, I actually think this is sort of exporting our sin here, because we take our history of slavery and we just dump that onto other people when they might have absolutely no. I mean, was there occasionally racialized slavery in Islamic civilization? Yes. Was there unacceptable exploitation of people in Islamic civilization? Yes. But I think if you took the Sharia understanding of slavery and even the general practice of slavery in Islamic civilization, I don't think it's comparable at all to plantation chattel slavery in the Americas. It's just not comparable at all. First of all, it was rarely racialized. Two, it was never tied to race. Three, slaves had a huge regime of rights. Four, slaves in numerous circumstances became the actual rulers or were used as the administrative elite. In fact, I would say that what we think about is kind of feudalism in medieval Europe, which is sort of a network of loyalties and duties and control of land and armies. It was managed through the idiom of oaths and fealty and swearing. That similar product was created in the medieval Islamic period through slavery. So you have the same kind of structure of loyalty and stuff created, but not through oaths, but through slavery relationships. It's a very different kind of slavery than we talk about. Slavery in Americas was an economic phenomenon. Slavery, and especially the Ottoman Middle East, was a social phenomenon. It was not an economic phenomenon. Is that clear? So I agree with you 100%, and I have I'm going to do a whole other article on slavery and Islamic civilization, and I'm going to do a whole other article on the abolition of slavery and Islamic civilization.
So we can then hold that.
Your point. I think you have a very weak argument.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm actually curious to hear what the weak argument is.
The weak argument is I wouldn't suggest American slavery would be
So, but my point is, why, let me ask you this question. You started saying wrongs done to by Arabs to other people. What wrongs?
Well,
just tell me. I know what you're going to say. I'll answer your question for you. The fact that there was slavery is a wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, that's, how can you say, if you're a Muslim,
you had slaves,
the Prophet of God, alayhi salam, had slaves. He had slaves. There's no denying that. Was he, are you more morally mature than the Prophet of God? No, you're not. I'll answer your question for you. So my point is, your assumption, we all go into, look, I feel the same way, right? So I'm American. My family owned slaves. Now, if I start thinking about slavery, you know, I start getting really nervous and uncomfortable and things like that. But the fact of the matter is that just because we take our word slavery,
well,
we should, I can tell you exactly what your argument is, and every point.
You're a BSP,
I have your argument correct. I have your argument correct, though, right?
You cannot have more argument.
You don't think that the, what you're saying is not that the fact of slavery is wrong.
I'm saying, if you look today, forget about, you know, the history, the slave trade you're talking about.
Yeah.
You go to the Gulf today, okay? We have slavery by any other name. You look at all the construction that.
Yeah.
You go to construction sites, you look at guys building buildings in flip-flops, you know, cut there and everywhere else. You know, we can sure you can clean that up. We're sure you can say, well, you got Sheriff Joe, you got a unicorn and 12 cents an hour in the federal BOP. We all know that. But that doesn't absolve their sins. It doesn't absolve their mistreatment of the workers. And it doesn't absolve their historical injustice.
So, but I understand what you're saying. So why don't we talk about problems of treatment of workers?
I'm all for that.
Yeah, but then why did you say, what did I do wrong? I'm not giving a talk on problems of treatment. I actually said we should focus on conditions of workers,
so
not on whether people are technically called slaves or not. That's a good, okay.
Yeah, so may I park this discussion for now and move on?
It's a very good discussion. This is exactly the discussion I want to have, but anyway, Armin won't let me have it.
I don't want it to be just discussion two people talking about everybody.
I think this is actually a discussion, my theory, a discussion everybody wants to have.
Yeah.
My point is, let's talk about actual conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not talk about words. Because if we're talking about slavery, we might not be talking. If we go and say, let's fight for the rights of Sokolu Mehmed Pasha, who's an oppressed slave. Sokolu Mehmed Pasha was not an oppressed slave, okay? He was a million times richer than any of us will ever be, and had a million times more people killed than any of us will ever have killed, God willing, right? And had a million times more power than any of us can ever imagine. So I'm not gonna go advocate for Sokolu Mehmed Pasha's rights. I'll advocate for the worker in the Gulf who's not a slave, technically, but who's being mistreated. So I think we sort of fetishize the word slavery. We morally fetishize it when we should actually be looking at the conditions of people. Wherever we're talking, what are the conditions there? Okay, and this last question was about the Mamluks. So this was this famous instance where Izzedine bin Abdul Salam, who died in 1262, famous Shafi'i scholar of Damascus and Cairo, called Sultan al-Ulama, one of the most respected scholars at the time and since then, that when Zahir Baybars, the first Mamluk sultan, sort of assumed the throne, Izzedine bin Abdul Salam said, he said, "Inni la'araka Baybars Bundukhtar." I know you, you're this you're that slave Bundukhtar. Now you're Zahir, the manifest Baybars. Because I don't believe you're free, I want to see your manumission document. And so there had to be this like sham sale of Zahir bin Bundukhtar so that he could prove he could reprove his freedom. But that was just Ibn Abdul Salam making kind of this point that, you know, you can't be slave in my ruler. But the Mamluks weren't, the point is they weren't slaves anyway. They were all free. But they were raised and reproduced themselves as a slave dynasty.
So this was not a real option.
No, it wasn't a real option. Zahir Baybars was the most powerful person in the Eastern Mediterranean at the time. But it does show how he had to go through the emotions of showing he was free to gain legitimacy in the eyes of the ulama.
Okay, so 1, 2, and 3 here, and then we'll take maybe one more round if we can. Okay, well.
Very quickly, you mentioned about your ancestors coming as indentured servants. My grandmother came as an indentured servant in the early 20th century. Slightly different circumstance, but her passage was paid and she had to work it off. So it was by a different name, it was the same thing. The question is, the people who, like, Sokol Mirna Pasha, who were working their way, or the other one, Saffron, who was working his way off at the slavery, if something happened to the master, did they revert to the estate or the child? Mm-hmm. So they still stayed slaves even though they were, and did the contract get voided in any way, or did they didn't have to start over again? If they had paid off 80%, they were still 80%.
That's actually a really good question. Are you a lawyer?
No.
You want to go one by one?
Yeah.
Let's take.
Next one. Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, it's not a question, just a comment. During the British time in India, the higher caste, the highest caste, was called Brahmin, still they exist. And the most lowest caste, they called Achut, it's the Indian word. Anyhow, the Brahmin elders thought that the moment they see the lowest caste Hindu, they will immediately become very impure. So Britishers allowed 2 hours those lowest caste Hindus, particularly in the South India, what they call Tamil Nadu region, they were allowed to go and do the shopping. It's just a comment, sir.
That's very interesting. Thank you very much.
Maybe there
was no rush hour, at least at that time.
Yeah. Thank you, Brother Jaffa. Okay.
You were about to say something about the moral sophistication about the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam when you were addressing the question about whether slavery was wrong, and you didn't finish your point. I was
having a theoretical argument with my friend here, the Canary fan.
Go on.
Oh yeah, I don't know anything about sports, so.
I feel like you're about to say something, but maybe I'm wrong.
It was a super interesting issue, but it gets in the issue of abolition of slavery, which is a whole other question. Let me answer these three questions. The first question is really good. So what happens if the slave, the mukatab slave, the one who's basically has a deal to pay off his freedom, or buy his freedom back by installments? What happens if the master dies? So he then becomes the property of the inheritors. And there's here at this point, you're going to get different schools of thought. But the main one would be that he just continues the same process with the inheritors. So one issue is not so much with the mukatab slave, but what's called tadbir. Tadbir was just as common, which is saying to your slave, you will be free when I die. So that was not a reversible statement. Once you made that statement, you couldn't go back on that. Now the problem was, if you're, let's say you're, the only asset you have is that slave, then you can't give more than 1/3 of your wealth away as a testimony, right? 70% of your estate has to go to the people that are Quranically fixed as your inheritors. So if what you've done is basically given all your assets away, because this guy's gonna be free when you die, and you've robbed your heirs. So at that point, either that slave becomes 1/3 free and 2/3 owned by the heirs, or let's say you have 3 slaves, you would do lots between them. So one of them would get free and 2 would remain the slaves, or each one would be 1/3 free. So basically, it's the question really comes into play when you've given away all your assets in the form of a slave who's in. But the mukatab is easy because the contract just continues to your children or the heirs. The real issue is, can you sell slaves who have? So if you sell a mukatab slave, then the relationship transfers to the new owner. So it's sort of like that status of the buying back in a mukataba status transfers over to between owners.
Brother in the back.
Yeah, about the moral issue. I mean, this is the
I wanted to kind of address this issue in my theoretical argument with my friend here, but the I just when he his comments, which by the way are completely understandable comments, I'm not criticizing them at all, but I'm saying what the reason why I wanted to discuss this issue of what slavery is first is because it's like talking about terrorism, right? You can't have a real discussion about terrorism if terrorism is just this moral, like, blunt axe that you just, it's impossible to handle, you know, it just, or this sort of moral burden on your back that you can't displace in order to have a discussion. But once, you know, when we talk about slavery, slavery cannot just be treated as a moral evil in and of itself, because slavery doesn't mean anything. The moral evil is extreme forms of deprivation of rights and extreme forms of control and extreme forms of exploitation. I don't think it's morally evil to own somebody, because we own lots of people all around us and we're owned by people. And this obsession with thinking of slavery as property, and it's treating human beings as sin, as things that is this just inconceivable sin. I think that's actually a really odd and unhelpful way to think about slavery, and it kind of gets you locked in this way of thinking where if you talk about ownership and people, that you've already transgressed some moral boundary that you can't come back from. But I don't think that's true at all. And so I think by the time I'm kind of trying to read to think about what slavery actually means, and to show that it doesn't really, the term doesn't really mean anything. That there's so many different phenomena that we would lump under this, and things we wouldn't lump under that we should, that we should sort of free ourselves from that burden first before discussing what riq was in Islamic tradition, or what the abolition of riq was in Islamic tradition.
Okay, we'll have time for just one more question here. We're almost out of time, so Louise, you were early wrong.
On this guy, too. We'll get two ones. Yeah.
Okay. The Bosnian, I have a little question and a big one. The Bosnian slaves who went over to Western Europe, that must mean that there's a good admixture of Bosnian and Western Europeans now.
You mean Bosnians who went to were in the Ottoman Empire?
You said they were sold into Western Europe as well.
Oh, yeah, early on, yeah.
So that's sort of
they
nice.
Weren't, but they were just Slavs.
Oh, well,
Slavs. But they, you know, they look like Europeans anyway. So
there'd be a nice Bosnian of some kind admixture in Western Europe, even so. And my other question was, what is it? Could you get back to what the other young man was talking about? Slavery back in the Prophet's time, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And what's in the Quran? There's a list of what you should do to be a good person, and the men who keep to themselves, except for their wives, wama malakat aymanuhum. That's a little jarring to Western ears, that their wives and.
Okay, so that's the next paper.
I'll take that. Take 1 second question. Yeah, then yes,
please go ahead.
Do you have a sense of what degree the contrast is between, say, an Islamic ideal of slavery and between the actual practice of Muslims throughout Islamic history, especially more in latter centuries, I mean, 18th century.
Yeah. I mean, so I'll answer the first question, second question first. The Islamic civilization is so broad and vast that, you know, slavery is always influenced by Islamic law, but mostly it's sort of a continuation of the pre-Islamic traditions of institutions of labor and sort of slavery and exploitation that are already there, right? So it's extremely varied. And you do have certain instances, for example, East African slave trade was like a lot more, you'd probably say, brutal than Ottoman sort of metropolitan domestic slavery in the Ottoman Empire. The interesting thing about Islamic law on slavery is that there's very little in the Quran about slavery. The Quran basically deals with slavery, and it encourages manumission of slaves, and it sets slaves, manumission of slavery, as the expiation for certain sins and certain crimes, which is, by the way, unique to Islam. Almost everything else in what becomes Islamic law of slavery is a continuation of existing traditions. because most of Islamic law and slavery actually comes from Muslims adopting existing practices in the Middle East.
There's a couple things that are specifically Islamic. One, children born of concubines have the exact same standing as children born of wives. That's actually, that's unique to Islam in the Near East. The idea of manumitting slaves as a way to expiate sins and compensate for certain crimes. Three, the idea that there is restrictions on, so for example, once you have a mukatab slave or a mukatab slave woman, you can no longer treat them in certain ways. If it's a slave woman, you can no longer, she can't be your concubine after that. The idea that, I think tadbir is an irrevocable promise. These things are unprecedented. So Islam introduces certain things, but a lot of it is continuity of the Near Eastern tradition. And so actually the reality of slavery is not that different from the legal ideal, because the legal ideal was kind of developed from the existing traditions with a little bit of inspiration from the Quran and the Sunnah. But I'd say where there was, in general, you don't find the brutality that you see in American slavery. And that's just, as far as I can tell, generally is simply not very common. Slaves in Islamic civilization were mostly investments. So one of the most common things is you would do is you'd have a slave, and it was like buying a rental property. So you basically say, okay, slave, you know, you're good at, you know, you're a good carpenter. Go out and work as a carpenter, and every day you give me like 30% of your pay. So they were basically, like in a sense, like walking rental properties. They would generate income for you. Then the last, the first question was about the concubines. So that's it's a very difficult discussion to have. I don't have time to have it today, but I mean, I would say that, not now. It's very hard to have this discussion because we think of, let's say, the modern United States, right? The sine qua non of morally correct sex is consent. We think of people as autonomous agents. Everybody's an autonomous agent. And it's the consent of that autonomous agent that makes a sexual action acceptable. Correct?
Correct.
If you take away the consent element, then everyone starts flipping out. At that point, now it is, then you get rape, you get sexual acts done by people who are too young, we perceive as too young to consent. And these are sort of the great moral wrongs of our society. So the idea of someone who is a by definition non-consensual sexual actor in the sense that they have been entered into a sexual relationship in a position of servitude, that's sort of ab initio wrong. The way I would respond to that is to say that this is just a fact. This isn't a judgment, this is a fact, okay? For most of human history, human beings have not thought of consent as the essential feature of morally correct sexual activity. And second, we fetishize the idea of autonomy to the extent that we forget, again, who's really free? Are we really autonomous people? And what does autonomy mean? Can I just drive, you know, can I be like a cowboy in some, you know, movie or action TV series where I just get on my motorcycle and ride to the West? No, I got kids. I have a mortgage. We're all born into and live in a network of relationships and responsibilities and duties. But we have this obsession with the idea of autonomy. And the fact is that, and this is not to demean the status of women in Islam or Islamic civilization at all, but a concubine's autonomy was not that different from the autonomy of a wife. Because for most of human history and most of Islamic civilization, women got married to the person that their family wanted them to get married to. The idea of being autonomous and saying, I need to be in love with him,
I need to go have this, you know, Jane Austen-like courtship with him. That was hogwash, right? You got, so what's the difference between someone who is captured in a raid in the steppes of Central Asia, brought to Istanbul slave market, sold to an owner who, by the way, might treat her badly, might treat her incredibly well. She's going to become, she's going to bear him children, she's going to be a free woman, she's going to be the mother of his children, she's going to, maybe if she's, if he's high status, she's going to be high status. If he die, if he dies, she might be a very desirable wife. That person's situation, what's the difference between that and some woman who's a poor, you know, baker's daughter who gets married to some baker's son without any choice, because no one expects her to have any choice, and that baker's son might treat her well, he might treat her horribly. What's the difference between these two people is not that big. We see it as enormous because we're obsessed with the idea of autonomy and consent. That'd be my best response. It's not a solution to the problem. I think it does help frame it.
And consent is understood to be present or required for it, but marriage is not. In other words, to consume sexual relationship nowadays, kind of common understanding.
Yeah, consent is important.
Marriage consent is important, marriage is not. Whereas, in, for instance, if you look at definition of marriage Islamically, marriage is the act that makes sexual relationship lawful.
Yeah.
Not consent itself, though consent is inbuilt into it through either direct or
proxy. But I mean,
I should say
that in, you know, technically speaking, in Islamic law, the consent of the wife is required. But what I mean is that, what does, if it's always understood that you're going to marry the person that your parents want you to marry, what does consent really mean? I mean, maybe if he's horribly ugly, you'll say, no, I don't want to do that. But I mean, what I'm trying to say is there is a difference between a wife and the concubine, and I think it is in an element of consent and autonomy. But that difference between them is not this massive difference that we would see it as today.
Okay, well, thank you very much. As Professor Brown said, he is writing actually at three... we're done with questions and comments. He's writing a series of three essays, I believe. Yeah. So. We'll